Welcome to the ADA podcast on tailored intensive treatment of selective mutism. Today we're talking with Dr. Stephen Kurtz, who is a psychologist, and he's the director of the Selective Mutism Program at the Child Mind Institute in New York City. And he's also the founder of the Brave Buddies Program. Welcome, Stephen. We're really glad to talk to you about this topic. Let me ask you a question. Can you explain what selective mutism is and what makes it a disorder, and as well, how common is it among children?
It's among the easiest things to describe, because if you can picture a kid who's a perfect chatterbox at home, not excessively talking, but just talking, flourishing, enjoying humor, being annoyed that he has to do his homework or take the garbage out, but talking unabashedly, and then goes out in public and literally may not say a word to a doorman, to a librarian, to a teacher, to a peer in school. Some of these kiddos will talk to those same peers at home. Some will talk to the same peers at the other kid's home, but not their home. So you get all of these elegant little algorithms where kids talk and don't talk. But the thing that defines it as selective mutism is the selectivity of it, that they remember their decision rules without error. So they know who they talk to, they know who they don't, they know which people, places, and activities are just verboten in terms of talking, and then go home and talk like chatterboxes.
So that is quite a bit different from being shy or sensitive or any of the other words that describe quiet kids, including those who have speech impairments. This sounds quite different.
So getting back to how common it is, there's some great data from Lindsay Bergman's studies and from some other people's studies indicating about 1 in 140 kids, so that would be about 0.7%, in young kids, like kids who are 4 to 7, that kind of age range. The difference between shyness and selective mutism is that people who are shy warm up. But it is now March 27th, and I'm getting calls of kids who have not spoken all year. I got a painful email yesterday from a parent in Canada whose child isn't talking to her or the father. So shy kids warm up. It may take 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 3 hours. In fact, DSM protects that by saying that if you have a new diagnosis, you can't make it in the first month of the school year, recognizing that many kids are slow to warm up.
Okay. What signs should a parent look for, and when should they bring their child in for an assessment? It sounds like timing is really important here.
Timing is key, and unfortunately, the data show that people come in about 2 to 3 years after they had real evidence that in some way it was getting in the way of the child's life, not just that they noticed a hiccup, but that they noticed that there was actually something that wasn't happening. So they should be looking for reports that the kid got injured and couldn't tell the nurse. They should be looking for reports that when it came time to do the show and tell, they chose not to, or not chose not to, that they didn't do it. They should be looking for signs that somebody is describing their child as excessively shy, not my word, their word, when in fact at home they don't think of their child as shy at all. So it's the differences in behavior across settings. And I would encourage parents to ask for feedback sooner rather than later when that becomes apparent. But we've had kids who've gotten on the wrong school bus and couldn't say anything, who've had bloody noses and couldn't say anything. We had a child with a broken arm who waited until everybody left the performance before telling her dad, who was a physician, only when he asked, "You look like you're in pain, is something wrong?" And she only pointed to her arm. So we're not talking about just hesitant to say your age when a lady comes up to you in the supermarket. We're talking about real impairment.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to get out there that it's identifiable, it's accessible, and it's treatable, and we can reliably assess down to the preschool years.
Okay, yeah, that was my next question. How early can it be diagnosed?
We diagnose kids at age 3 very, very confidently.
Okay.
If it's age 2, the younger they are, the more we'll really have to take into account are there speech or language deficits. Turns out that with some very good recent work out of Philadelphia, out of LaSalle, that they've identified a fair percentage of kids who have language problems. Also found out that when their parents were trained to administer the tests, they look less sick, if you will, less impaired, than when trained speech and language persons were giving the tests, but they still were impaired. So there's still fairly high rates of comorbid speech and language issues.
Let's talk about treatment then. What works, what doesn't work, what are effective ways to treat this disorder, and also let me ask you what the Brave Buddies program is.
I'm so glad you asked. The good news is that we know how to treat this. The bad news is it's up to me and my colleagues to make it scalable and sustainable. So it's so treatable, and we can teach it so well that we can take college students who simply have a good attitude, maybe a Psych 101 class behind them, and in a matter of days teach them the same skills that we use. Obviously, they're not therapists, so they're not going to generate the treatment plans, but they can become effective guides to the kids to do more brave talking. So treatment happens either in a behavioral route, and that can subdivide into either individual treatment for an individual family, if you will, or in a group context, like a group of kids, or a medicine route, or a combination. There have been some trials of medicine only. Very, very few people. I can count on one finger the number of clinicians I know who would recommend that as a first course of treatment. But when we talk about intensive treatment, we mean both intensifying the dose of the behavioral therapy and being willing to combine it with medicine where necessary. I responded to an email on the web this morning saying that it's criminal that we think of combining medicine and behavior therapy as a last resort rather than the best treatment option that we have available. So ADA has been at the forefront in helping get out the results of the CAMS study. Now, CAMS didn't focus specifically on SM, but there are lessons to be learned from co-treating with medicine and behavior therapy, kids who have anxiety disorders. So the behavioral treatment to be kid-friendly, after all, we're talking mostly about kids under 7. So it's up to me and my team and those of us around the world who do this to make it all kid-friendly. So we do exposures, but we have to do shaping one small increment at a time. So it may be that they're whispering first to us in the side of the room. It may be then that they're talking a little bit louder. It may be then that we go to the library. It may be then that we go to their classroom when nobody's in it, and a series of shapings.
Now, let's talk a little bit about medication. How do you know which children might need medication or when it's not called for?
We've, at ChildMind, developed an algorithm that we're very comfortable with. The parents and the professionals that we share it with seem to be comfortable with it. And it's basically this. If you're an older kid who's got serious impairment, comorbid diagnoses, a very strong family history, and you haven't responded to some therapy already, then you're a kid that we're going to want to medicate probably even before we start our behavioral treatment with you. On the other hand, you're a young child, SM is your primary diagnosis, you don't have really severe impairing other diagnoses, you haven't tried CBT yet, your family history isn't so strong that your parents can't even let you be in a room with us, we're certainly going to start with behavioral therapy. But we expect a really rapid return on investment. So within 3 sessions, most of our kids are talking to us with a parent out of the room, even though they come in so impaired. So we set a very high bar for ourselves about moving these kids forward, and that's why we're not afraid to bring in medicine as needed. There's no reason kids should suffer.
Oh, that's good. What role do parents play in helping their children overcome selective mutism?
If you took video clips of my sessions over the last 15 years of this journey, you'd see probably an exponential rise in the role of the parents in the treatment. Once we discovered that we knew how to help these kids talk, then the only stopping point or the only block for us was how to get the people who live with these kids to do the same techniques. So literally yesterday on the flight here, I'm reading an email from a dad who went with his son to the playground on a weekend, then went with his son to the playground on a weekday, then went with his son to the cafeteria when nobody's in it. That dad learned the techniques from us, and he's the one who's then helping his child move forward. The end of the email was, and his quote-unquote sink or swim litmus test was that he passed his swimming test at the Y, where he had to say his name, his age, and so when dad said it was a sink or swim, he meant that literally and figuratively,
yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So our parents are absolutely critical.
Good. That's good. What is the role of the school and the child's teachers in this treatment, and how can parents make sure that their teachers and others in the school, the cafeteria people, the people on the playground, can participate in the right kind of treatment?
ultimately, everybody who deals with this child is either going to do things with them that help them progress, or they're going to do things that keep the avoidance of talking going forward. There's no neutral. Unless you're just sort of walking by me, you're either going to try and engage me and stay with me until I talk, or you're going to start getting into asking me yes-no questions, and I'm just going to nod to you. And you're going to think we had a conversation. But we really didn't. You just reinforced me for nodding and pointing and gesturing. So it's so key that we get what most people refer to as a key worker in the school who learns the skills from us and then kind of transfers that baton to other people in the school. I've worked with janitors. I've worked with librarians. I've worked with principals who are the saddest people because they're often last on the hierarchy and they've known these kids since they entered school. It's so sad. So the involvement of the school is key. These kids don't necessarily have to be getting 504 accommodation plans. They don't necessarily have to be in special education. Most are not. But they need to give us the space to go in, for example, and decontaminate the classroom that is heretofore contaminated. We need to get in there at 7:30, get 20 minutes of practice time in before the other kids come in. And a week doesn't go by that me and my clinicians aren't doing that, or that the parents aren't providing that, or that somebody in the school who's been trained is providing that. Absolutely key.
Let me ask you about siblings, too, older siblings. They must play a role in this.
We love siblings. I'll give you a recent example. We had a boy come from Italy, and I was so excited that his two older sisters came because they actually caught on to the skills quicker than the parents, and I was able to train them to be his therapists in vivo when we went out and did community exposures. Now, we've been able to fade them so that when he comes back for Brave Buddies this summer, they won't be with him. But the siblings are going to get jealous of all this positive attention if we don't include them, and they are a fabulous resource. And frankly, everybody in the family system has been used to accommodating in a negative way the child's mutism up until then. So if we don't teach the sibs what to do, they have no choice but to keep doing what they've already done.
Yeah, which probably comes more naturally in many ways. Is there a typical length of time in which you see results? You mentioned three sessions.
There is a typical length of time in which we must see results, and that is quickly. This is not your grandmother's psychotherapy. I say to people that what I learned in grad school I would now call malpractice, and I stand by that. I can't tell you how many reports we get of kids who've been in what the parents describe as play therapy for an extended period, and the parents are either happy or not that the kid is simply talking to the therapist. That is not our goal. Our goal is to get them talking to us so that we can get them talking to other people. So we're looking to transfer that baton. So we actually developed some benchmarks, which is, for example, if by 8 sessions they're not talking to us with their parents out of the room, we know we need to change our treatment plan. If by 12 sessions we're not in the school with the child and they're not talking there to somebody else, then we know the treatment plan needs revising, intensifying it in some way. Maybe doing a 15 to 20 hour intensive treatment. Maybe us going with the kid to school for 3 days that week. Maybe them coming to do the Brave Buddies group. Maybe adding medication. But something needs to change, and we advocate for expecting good results.
Good. So does this treatment cure a child, or is this something there can be relapses, or is it the chronic condition that they and the family and everybody around them has to continually support, even long-term?
Yeah, it's an awesome question because disorder by disorder, with what psychologists and psychiatrists and other mental health folks treat, there are different answers to that. There are some things that are phasic. Depressions tend to come in phases and remissions. OCD outbursts or intensifying comes in waves. Tics certainly come in waves. With this, once we get kids cured, we essentially get them cured, and kids do get cured, which made me really excited to be a doctor because my other hat is ADHD, and I don't expect to cure kids. I expect to help them live within their skin, help the world learn to live with their propensities. So when I hit on this, I felt really good that we could achieve that. The first child that I treated in what I call the modern era, when I arrived at NYU, just emailed me last week. He's now a pilot. I can assure you, because my brother's a pilot, you can only become a pilot if you can talk under stressful circumstances. He emailed me because he's doing his senior thesis on overcoming SM and wanted to interview me because he said, you have a unique perspective on who I was when I was 4.5 years old and not talking. Every kid gets somewhat better. We don't really have good long-term outcome data, so I don't like to overpromise to parents, but every family that stays in treatment, they really do get better. They just do.
That's good. That's hopeful, too.
It's sort of the multi-systemic therapy approach to therapy, which is that it's our job to get people better with them. I mean, we can't make them get better, but it's our job not to give up on them and use their barriers as our excuse for their not getting well.
Got it. Is there anything else you'd like to add about this and the treatment?
So I think you asked me before, what is Brave Buddies? I never got around to really just saying exactly what that is. So years ago, I was at a national conference for another professional group, and I sat in the back room on a Sunday morning, and Jill Ehrenreich and Lawrence Santucci were presenting on an intensive camp they had done for kids with separation anxiety. I slapped my head and said, oh, my Lord, I can't believe I've never thought of this before, because I'm a dyed-in-the-wool camper. In fact, as I sit here with you, I'm wearing a vest of a camp that I worked at, coincidentally, a camp I worked at for troubled kids in New York. What I decided to do was to model an analog classroom. So we take kids in a group, and actually now we have 25 kids, so it's two groups, and we set up an analog classroom for an entire week. And what we do is practice over and over and over and over all those things that they avoid doing over and over and over and over. So in show and share, every kid does show and share. For expert demonstration, every kid does expert demonstration. When we go to order ice cream, we prep the kids on day one just by asking what's your favorite flavor. On day two, we have a sort of Sunday making activity in the classroom. By day four, we're going to Baskin-Robbins or some other establishment together, and we've already told the folks behind the counter, just give our kids some time, and they do, and the community's been really helpful with that. So Brave Buddies is an analog classroom for a week, and every day the parents get 60 to 90 minutes of parent training, where we actually train them on the skills, not just give them handouts about how to do it, but we actually bring them in to do it, and we have a live video feed into the kids' room so that they get to see our counselors demonstrating and modeling the very same skills.
So can people find that on bravebuddies.com or something?
They can find it at childmind.org.
Okay.
And I'm super proud and happy to say that we've had several replications around the country. Carmen Linus here in Chicago has done it for 3 years in a row. The folks at BU and now in BU as well as Florida International University. So if they go on the websites of any of those programs, they'll definitely see information.
And they can find you.
And you ask me anything else. I just want to say to families who may get to listen to this or to therapists who may get to listen to this, we have every reason to expect these kids to get better. So we really have to not be satisfied with pediatricians, well-intentioned though they may be, who say let the child grow out of it. For grandparents who say you're nudging your kid, the data show the kids don't tend to grow out of it. They tend to get worse. And the average child with an anxiety disorder is at risk for more anxiety disorders as they get older, thus the ADAA and its mission to educate and inform.
Good. Well, thank you. This has really been very interesting and eye-opening. And it's nice to know that you can cure. I'm putting that in quotes, but it's nice to know that. We don't often hear that. I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Kurtz at the Child Mind Institute in New York. This is Jean Tycho for ADAA.